not for not beyond technical terms. You know, I knew the basic Buddhist technical terms, but nothing beyond that. So then I went. I wrote my thesis based on his work, which was some aspects of the Prajnaparamita Madhyamika tradition in Buddhism. So, and then I worked with him for some time, and then I returned to Reed to present my thesis. That wasn't until late 71.
Well, I don't know whether you people have given it much thought or not, but to me now, who is, you know, not studying at all such one, it has always puzzled me, how would all those Indian brains, you might say,
yeah,
and with all that intricate philosophical thing and religious thing, how the heck the Indian continent got into such a mess? Has anybody ever tried to equate the two things together?
Hmm.
Huh? You've got all these things to talk about tranquility and then the largeness of soul and all that, and you never run across a more grasping bunch of guys than the Maharajas and the princes. Huh?
Yeah.
Self-serving, selfish.
Yeah.
See? Egotist. You know?
Well.
Now, was it the plan of the great maker to go ahead and then have these guys suffer all through hell to aggrandize a few handful of people?
Yeah.
Where is that eternal justice?
The Buddha's response to that is that Buddhism is not Indian. You know, Buddhism comparable to, Dr. Kanzi says Buddhism is that form of Hinduism which can be exported. So you don't need. Buddhists are not in exile any place in the world, unlike the Hindus, and unlike the Jews for that matter. You know, so it's comparable to Christianity in that respect. Also, Christians are not in exile any place. For the Jews, every year it's Lashana Havo v'Yerushalayim. Next year in Jerusalem we'll do it, you know. But for a Buddhist, it doesn't matter. India was a sort of a vessel for Buddhism. China was a vessel for Buddhism. Japan was. America is. So there's a sort of a continuity beyond national character. So it's not a negative reflection on what's essential to Buddhism, that India is a mess.
Well, of course, from that point of view, then I suppose it doesn't matter what the heck happened to where Buddhism is. The whole thing, the mere thing is that Buddhism is still surviving, no matter where it is, and whatever the place is, it doesn't care if the place goes to hell.
Well,
you think that sounds rather sardonic to me, you know.
Yeah. No, it's not like that. It's not like that. Although, you know, Gary Snyder's point of view is that historically speaking, Buddhism has demonstrated it to be socially rather irresponsible and has not addressed fundamental social questions. Other people disagree with him, and I don't have the historical background to know, but perhaps
that
could be
argued. Gary would be thinking in that way. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
Gary, would have the practical turn of mind to go ahead and look into it that way. But I could also understand why that it would seem to be that way. But if the philosophy is purely for the enlightenment, for that individual given over to the pursuit of its philosophy, you know, and tenet, then the totality of the thing in which this man stands is a no moment. See? So India can go to hell as long as one Indian has the true light, you know? See? I mean, not in such a cold-blooded way, but you get the idea that one is relatively unimportant compared to this other one holding the flame bright, you see.
But the question would be, for whom is he holding this flame? Is it for himself, or is it for his community?
Well, for another one that would want to be like that.
Another one, yes.
And if you get another one, and another one, and another one, eventually, then the whole thing will be the land of enlightenment. See?
Perhaps something
only be reached that way, not by wholesale declaring all you do is worship this light and then India will be blessed.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Gary once said that the mercy of the East is individual insight into the basic self-void. The mercy of the West is social revolution. And perhaps there's
something like what we just said.
Yeah, yeah.
You see that you do it by yourself, and in this way inspire the other to follow the sample, and then get enough of like that, and then you will be a preponderant.
Right. Yeah. The thing is that if it were just for one person to produce one person, and in a sense you can say that, but the fact that the thread of tradition is continually carried by millions of people. It wouldn't be so if it weren't working for them in one way or another. You know, people would not tolerate it.
Oh yeah, you would. Yeah, that because it's logical to come to that conclusion. You see, nothing. This is irrefutable.
Yeah.
See, because if the thing were totally wrong, God dang it, they would have been wiped out.
That's right. Yeah.
See, the people in anger would rise up and say, "What the heck are we tolerating this for?"
Right. Yeah. Like you say, your example of the survival of Jewish. Tradition. It's the same thing. The very fact that it exists, and that's why when we say, when we use the word primitive and academically it's frequently used as a sort of pejorative, but in fact, you know, I think a useful way is to consider it a term of respect for the simple fact that it has endured, it has roots that have endured back to the primitive. You know, it's just simply has survived so long and therefore is worthy of respect.
Well, I mean, in the modern psychological studies, especially the Jungian school, they're saying that the fact that modern man seems to get kind of lost is the fact that he's kind of rejecting that thread. He's been cutting it in midway.
Precisely.
See? Yeah. And if there's culture, then evidently, then following on that premise, those cultures that are able to have maintained that thread. Yeah. So no matter what vicissitude has gone through, it may be high, it may be low, it is really in a better survival stage than others, which seemingly look stronger at the moment.
Yeah.
Look how strong Hitler's regime was. No one, from a common sense point of view, nothing will beat it.
Yeah.
But where is it now?
Yeah.
You see?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, because the thing actually was with that one man.
Yeah.
With him gone, what did it lead to? Where was the thread?
Yeah.
Yeah? Right. It broke up into a thousand pieces.
Yeah. That's But the question about Buddhism and the mess that's India, you know, it's.
I think that would be a common use as a common start of criticism.
Yeah. Well, you're not so comfortable with Buddhism, I think. Isn't that true? So?
No, I've never even paid much attention, for that matter.
Well, I remember discussing it with you years ago, and you expressed the sense that Zazen practice, for example, smacked of a kind of spiritual calisthenics, something like that.
Oh, you mean that? Well, see, this has something to do with the Chinese attitude on all those things.
Yeah.
Which that, you see, the thing must come from a sort of a spontaneous welling.
Yeah.
From within, and not the mere bunch of exercises go through by rote without even trying to understand, to get at the essence.
Yeah.
That was the whole idea, not as a deriding of the whole thing.
Oh, I understand. But there's the question of the balance between the spuriousness of what we call natural, and then on the other hand, you know, self-discipline, ongoing practice, and perhaps that can easily move into something.
But you see, Zen itself mentioned that the importance of that natural thing, like in the art of archery thing, where the Zen master shot that arrow without looking, you know, and he said, "It did it," you know? You see, the whole idea is that the it, you see the whole point. You don't get the it by just going through ritual.
Yeah.
See, the ritual may be a conditioning of the person to this idea of setting his mind, concentrating his energy.
Right.
But if we don't get away from this idea as this ritualistic thing is more important than the it part, discovering the it, then I think we kind of lost it, have we gone through all the travail.
Yeah.
See? Yeah. Just exactly like this hark back to the point where the boxing master said,
"That's right.
It will come when you get this down pat."
Right.
See? Yeah. Yeah. See?
Yeah. That's exactly.
Yeah.
Right. I remember it was interesting to me to hear you say earlier that your feelings about Gary Snyder's recent prose, the intelligibility of his writing lately, because the first time I ever talked to you, I remember, you were, I was very interested in his work, and you compared him somewhat unfavorably to Allen Ginsberg, and you said that this, if you, you know, when you read his poetry, you notice there's a sort of harshness to the rhythms. It's rather, and it lacks the gentleness, the real genuine gentleness that comes through Alan's work, for example. Mm-hmm. And
Alan is a gentle person.
Yeah, right. Yeah. You know that Yevtushenko once commented, he was asked about Ginsberg's work, and he said, I consider the Sunflower Sutra an absolute stroke of genius.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was the thing that struck me was that the time that Alan came and he was still in touch with me, you know. I remember one day when he was going to give that reading at the Woodcraft, maybe it was a Woodcraft Hall, I get a phone call, you know. And he was just, hey, this is Alan, Charlie. Yeah, and I've left word at the desk, you know, for any number of tickets you want for you and your friend. You know.
Oh, yeah.
My God. And then another day, he had given us a workshop at Portland State. Uh-huh. And I get a call at 10 o'clock in the evening. He said, say, Charlie, we just finished over at the PSU. How about joining me at the restaurant?
Oh, yeah.
He come down in his car, you know, and got there. It was a young professor who drove the Golden Dragon. And we had all Chinese the meal there.
Yeah.
And I said, let me treat you, Alan. Oh, no, I'm on an expense account. And he took care of it. And then we drove back. And then we took him. He was staying at that Ramada Inn, I think, up near Portland State.
Oh, yeah.
And this young man was a professor at Portland State U. And so we got out of the car. I was sitting in then, and Alan being big, you know, he sat in the back by himself in that little folk crowd.
Right.
So I got out of the seat. He got out. And then right on the sidewalk, he wrapped me in a bear hug, you know, and I bust me on both cheeks. And this young professor, he was absolutely shocked. And I thought to myself, I said, so much for the modern sophisticated, you know. See? I said, what the heck was he there? And then later on it dawned on me, evidently I'd heard this stuff about Alan being a gay, you know, and stuff like that. But I said, whatever. Here's his expression of our affection for each other, you know, and nothing to do with gay or not gay, you see. Yeah? But for that guy to be so shocked, he drove me back from that motel back to my house in complete silence. I said, for crying out loud, I said, this is crazy.
Oh, yeah.
And before that, he was so voluble, you know.
Uh-huh.
See? But I have always liked Alan.
Yeah.
From the very first, I met him when Gary joined with him in a reading at UW.
Oh.
Way back in the early 50s.
Oh, really?
At Parrington Hall.
Oh.
And then that's when he introduced me to him. And, I had sold some of his books at Reed Bookstore before, you see.
Yeah.
Howl and Gasoline and stuff like that. And so I said, so this is Alan.
Hmm.
And we didn't get talk much at the first time, but I don't know, for some strange reason, he must have developed a sort of an acceptance of this strange creature.
Right.
So I took the bunch down to Chinatown and set up a dinner. And Stanley Kunitz was there. He was poet in residence. He was a Pulitzer winner.
That's right. For a year, about 5 or 8 years ago, he was at the Library of Congress, curator of the Library of Congress. Uh-huh.
Well, anyway, here we were at that Reed fellow's house, Homer Mattson's house.
Mm.
And he was working at the post office then. And he and his wife there were living there with the 5 kids. Oh, my God, that place is a ramshackle thing there. Right under the University Bridge, you know, in that area.
Yeah.
Yeah, by the lake. God dang it. Well, we got out. I couldn't get over, you know, these people covered in the young students are worshiping the great, you know. little young girls and all that, the lip majors and Anthill men and Gary and all those holding forth. And I think at the time that they were still a little diffident about declaiming on certain Oriental things in front of me. I noticed, especially in the Far East department, with these grad students, you know. I came down the hall one day to go back to work, and I was already, well, at that time I was already on the faculty.
Oh, yeah.
And this Dr. O'Kent, they was holding forth on the philosophy of Confucius. You could hear him out in the hallway. I turned into the room, and my God, the decibel dropped to minus zero. Yeah, boy, he was confident. Oh, Confucius was this, Confucius was that, and the emphasis was this. See, and I walked in there. Nobody said a word. They couldn't even breathe. Yeah, it's strange, you know, see? How confident one moment, what's wrong? I mean, discuss it. See? That's the only way, you see? And we keep our academic thing and then shut it down and just play our little private ideas among a sympathetic circle.
That's right.
You are not going to get any enlightenment, you see? And I think this is the way we watch your work, Gary and Philip grow, you know?
Right.
They grew because they were willing to listen a little. Well, of course, Gary at first was just as diffident like that about certain things. See, he wasn't too sure, you know. See? And then, of course, he had a lot of stagecraft, too. See? I remember he went around and he was like, I couldn't get over that. Here I am, a pure-blood Chinese, and I don't know what I'm going on. At the time when I was at Washington, there was this young woman who was a Woodrow Wilson scholar. And she went into the Chinese section. And by gosh, she was a good-looking woman. After we had been acquainted for a while, and she was in a few of my classes, I started noticing it one day because of a thing that happened during the class. Well, up in the upper level, all those being doctoral candidates, I was the only one that was working for BA. We were all required to recite. You see, we made sight translation of pieces. And you had no way of knowing when you'd be called upon, you see, so well, you better know your stuff. And I think that was good exercise.
Yeah.
And this one day, the girl was called upon to do the translation for that hour. And she read the piece, and first she read it in Chinese, then she translated in English. Then read another line in Chinese, translated in English. And she got through what all of us who listened would marvel at a workmanlike job. It wasn't polished, a gem, you know, because you can't do that. And the professor, oh, that was very well done. See? And yep, we joined in. Oh, yes, yes. And we mentioned the girl's name. Yeah, very, very, very good. And you know what the girl said? I don't get it. She was just a goddamn transcribing machine. Here she was saying the words. She had a chance to say it in two languages. And it never registered in her mind the continuity of the thoughts expressed. You ever run across anybody like that?
Yeah.
And it just worried me. I said, if this is the type of people that gets a scholarship, well, now I said, what the heck is going to happen to the meaningful work that's going to be turned out? See? That would be horrible, wouldn't it? No. It was just beyond comprehension.
Yeah.
See? No. So, now what the heck was this going to be leading to? That this is an insertion along the way.
Yeah.
See? What the heck was I going to say? But I thought that incident so noteworthy.
You were talking about the diffidence that some people showed when they were when they came around to talking about Chinese.
Oh, that woman, yeah, later on mentioned. There was a connection with Gary.
Yeah, yeah.
And so after we had been acquainted, she said, do you, she knew that I was from Reed, you know.
Yeah.
Do you happen to know a student named Gary Snyder? Oh, that's Gary, of course. She said, very good friend. There was a lot of him. Oh, well, he said, I hadn't experienced it that man. I said, well, what happened? Well, you know, we got acquainted in the Oriental class, and he invited me to his place, and I understood that he had rented a little cottage, caretaker's cottage, outside of the main house, not behind. So that evening when he invited me, see, I went, see, and the date of him before, but I went anyway, so... She went past the front, walked down the side, said walk, and went to the little cottage in the back. She says, when I got into the room, there he was, in the middle of the floor. There was nothing in the room. It was all bare. Nothing on the wall, nothing on the floor. And there he was, right in the center of the room, just sitting there cross-legged. I said, what happened? I said, nothing. Yeah, after a few exchanges, she just went quietly home. And I knew then that would be Gary at that early stage. Because, of course, it was leading to, you know, these little mannerisms and putting on a sort of a show, you know. This window dressing thing. I didn't tell him all. Well, I figured that in time those things would be tamed down quite a bit, and then it did. Yeah. After he'd been to Japan, he got married, you know.
Yeah.
See, at first he was still sporting a lot of these native garments and stuff. You know. Of course, in Philip's case, well, he's an ordained priest, and that's perfectly okay.
Yeah. See? Well, Gary was ordained also. But what I heard is that he didn't even know it. Mm-hmm. His master took him and did some ceremony with him.
Yeah.
And he said later when he knew the language, he was looking through these things and he realized that he had received ordination.
That's really, he shouldn't have done it that way.
He should have given
the person some inkling.
Yeah, I should say so. Yeah. Philip, on the other hand, he once told me that he virtually demanded to be ordained. And Baker, even though he didn't, he hadn't practiced at Zen Center for so long at that time, Baker Roshi commented that Philip has been a priest for 20 years already, even though not in the same formal sense that...
I noticed that about Philip, you know, even before he went into the thing formally. And there was a certain, really in a way, a certain vulnerability about the man. He was, easily touched and moved. I don't know whether he struck you that way.
Oh, yeah.
You see? And, it made me feel protective, too, in a way.
Oh.
You know, I'm being so much older.
Yeah.
I looked upon some vulnerable young brother, you see? And, yeah, in fact, that's why I looked upon all of them as younger brothers. And so, it was easy to be very compassionate.
Yeah.
About their failures and their little struggles.
Yeah.
Of course, Lloyd now is a man that is an unusual combination. Yeah. I really think that he was really at Reed College, you see. He had the audience that was understanding, you know, the quality of student were you know, really suit a man like that. But unfortunately, the administration itself is not of a type that really could bring the two together into a greater flowering.
Maybe that made it, in some sense, since he was always struggling with the administration, maybe it may have fueled his kind of creative energy and what he prepared students with, because the students, of course, are going into situations in which there's not that kind of support all the time.
Well, you see, really, being the school it is, where you're sort of driving toward a compressed type of a program, you know, is it very highly compressed. It doesn't really fit in with the whole idea of that Oriental philosophy.
Mm.
You know, I wouldn't say the Oriental thing is laissez-faire, but it is certainly not this high-pressure type of thing, you see. If there's any intensity, the intensity is a sort of a restrained intensity, you see, in Oriental striving, see, so that you become much more concentrated when you release the bow, huh?
That's right.
You see? And of course, with it being like that, you reduce the effectiveness of a man like Lloyd.
Yeah.
I think had Lloyd been given a more sensitive administrative overseeing,
that
he would have done the student much more good.
Yeah. He left after 40 years of teaching with the statement, the school is too rigid for me. It's so hard to imagine. It's just absolutely incredible.
Well, he was fighting an uphill battle, I think. Yeah. I know all the time I was there, when he found out that here was someone who was fairly knowledgeable in the certain aspects of Oriental, the Oriental field, let's say something should be done with it, you see. Not so much in the esoteric way, but in a bread and butter type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in that way I could have contributed something. So he tried to set up something in the way of an Oriental chair of some kind.
Yeah.
But no, they wouldn't have a dang thing to do with it. I know that beforehand because I sensed it when I took the course.
Yeah.
The completely driving, you know, stressing, emphasizing the fact there was no other world but the West.
That's right, yeah.
See? I don't know whether you felt it.
Oh, definitely, without question. There was the Eastern Hemisphere was not recognized. My work in Buddhism was completely... I did independent studies in Chinese art with Lloyd.
Yeah.
I did independent study in Buddhist philosophy with Ed Garland. Mm-hmm. I did a thesis in Buddhist philosophy under... Dr. Kanze,
mm-hmm.
and I did Chinese Mandarin study in the summertime at a different school. Nothing at Reed, formally within the curriculum.
And here I was trying to push over the Reed attitude on the idea of integrating the various disciplines into a form of a Far Eastern humanity. I was trying to talk it through at Washington with about as much success as Lloyd got through at Reed in respect to the Oriental program. And I don't know, I figured that if you're self-confident enough, what do you have to do worry about another culture? I certainly am not worried about the West awning me or in any way.
Yeah.
See, I can maintain my Eastern identity no matter what you try to sell me. You see? So I said, if your culture is so sensitive to outside forces and you're afraid you're going to lose your children because of that, I said, boy, you're in a bad way.
Yeah.
No.
What they say, their comeback on that was, if I remember, something like, well, it's not the point, Eastern or Western humanities. The point is teaching you how to think and giving you the tools of education. And therefore, the content of it is something that you will, you know, accumulate over the many years.
Well, of course, it's an easy way to say it. No, then Eastern knowledge is not education.
Well, that's their argument is, well, it is very much education. However... we do not, I mean, what I remember with the religion department that I was engaged with was, we would love to have somebody teach Eastern religion here, but then, of course, we'll need a Sanskrit department, and we'll need a Chinese department.
Yeah, sure.
We'll need the whole language.
Yes, always like answer the government give out. Of course, we're going to study solar energy, but how are we going to go ahead and work freaking away how to do ahead and start a plant where we can supply 1 billion kilowatts?
That's right, yeah.
What the hell? Is that the way you started with the electrical program?
Yeah.
You see?
Right.
Hey, no, the whole thing, that's just a kiss-off.
Of course,
all.
And the same thing with black studies. The point that Lloyd made when they were still talking about black studies was, what are you talking about? We don't have qualified people teach you We could manufacture PhDs, you know, in 6 years.
I had that joke there at Lloyd. Yeah. I said, well, I want to start a class in teaching how to build igloo. Now, where are you going to get a PhD who holds a degree in igloo building there? I said, you got all kind of Eskimo who know how to build an igloo. Now, you go ahead and get an accredited PhD in igloo. Huh? Design. For crying out loud. And all the time, you're not going to start a class in teaching how to build an igloo because there's no qualified PhD in igloo building.
Right. Yeah.
See? You got to start somewhere. The journey of 1,000 miles begins on the foot, you know.
Right. Yeah.
See? And they're trying to tell you, you got to have the itinerary marked out. You see? And it's a kind of good thing there. They're doing the same thing they criticize the other side for. Exactly. See, the others are backward because they didn't know how to do this. They didn't do this. They didn't do that. And they're doing the same thing. You see? You can't have a goddamn forest department if you don't have any guy starting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was, people reach me and say, well, you have a few volume of Chinese things that you donate to. I said, what for? I said, they're not making any use of it.
Right.
I said, just like in Princeton University. The only one who has made any use of that God-frigging library with his $1 million worth of volume and stuff like that was this the librarian, Nancy Lee Swan. And she wrote the book on Ban Chao, the first woman general in China.
Oh.
Isn't that great? That was good for her female lib, you know. What the hell have you got to do with the study of Chinese history?
Yeah.
But these things so hip, then they hear the whole resource. It comes out with a book on the first woman general in China. And this is show that a woman can be a general.
Yeah.
Any little 12-year-old Chinese kid can tell you that. They know the story. I first heard about Ban Chao when I was in the Chinese school in Portland. We didn't make an issue of it. Yeah, we know. Yeah, women can be good, great general. So what? You see? But it's these little things that like that. Everything has got to be made into some cockamamie issue. You see? But as we jokingly talked about before, you know, crabs have different ways, you know. They're crabs that are the same size, mate, and pair. They're crabs that keep them kept male, you know. Huh? And all the time that monkey, no crap. Incidentally, that was in the state of Maine was tried on a little different thing, with different animals. See, the deer population was going down. So how in the hell are they going to go ahead and maintain the deer population? We're in a big hunting state, you know. So somebody came up with a wild idea. Why don't we shoot some of the does? Before, you see, it was just shooting the biggest a deer, you know,
yeah.
The stag. That was the head to hang up in the clubhouse, you know,
yeah.
With a 10-pointed antler.
Yeah.
They completely forgotten the nature's way of building up the herd. So what the hell the guy did with modern weapons was to wipe out the stag, the leader of the herd, every time. And each time a new leader came, the first thing to do, some goddamn buckle with his high-power rifle, wiped him out with the first shot.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the does were all there, and they were picked up by the inferior buck. So each year, your goddamn herd went down grade, and then, of course, each year there was a better stag, but then they kept wiping it out, and in 20 years' time, there was no strong male.
Yeah.
So they decided getting rid of this doe. They allowed them to shoot a doe. Did you know, in 8 years' time, that dang herd was built so that the main deer herd, they were threatening the dang thing with overpopulation. Okay? Now, where the hell did those biologists and zoologists go to school? You study nature, you don't even know the goddamn rhythm of the wild. See? And our salmon right now, they're worried about it. It's very easy, you know, but then you try and get them to do it. See? The old-time fishermen, when they had, I remember the time I worked in a cannery, we had packs of 200,000 cases. In Bellingham, the largest cannery in the world at one time, I was born there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They had a pack of 470,000 cases, 1 pound cases. Okay? And I worked in the cannery when they were bringing in the fish in scows. Four scow load of fish from the traps. The discard they make at the bottom fishes enough to keep a Portland market running for 2 months. That's just for one lift of the trap.
Yeah.
And what the heck? Now they say, gee, the whole goddamn Columbia pack don't amount to 280,000 fish.
Yeah.
Well, your dam killed them all. See? And when the fish try to establish themselves in a new stream where they can reach, the fish commission itself step in and wipe them out because they wouldn't be patrolable. They couldn't get the maximum license out of them. 1 year, the salmon in Portland were going up Johnson Creek. Can you imagine that? They were spawning into Johnson Creek. The fish commission immediately sent people up there to erect a damp barrier to keep out the spawning salmon. Because, you see, all the work they had done on Johnson Creek had clarified the water, purified it, and they had a strong, swift channel, and the fish, following the natural inclination, were going up a stream that was new and clean.
Yeah.
And they dammed it. Because, you see, if they didn't dam it, when the fish get up beyond a certain level, the water is shallow enough, people can go out in the water and pick the salmon up by hand. And you couldn't get any fishing license.
Right.
They weren't thinking of the preservation of the salmon, you know.
Yeah.
Okay? No bureaucrat is going to be safe. If people can get fish like that, why the hell should I go down and buy a $5 license? Or $10 license? Eh? Now, you guys, your fishing commission could be abolished. Your hatchery guys will have no job.
Yeah.
Eh? And they destroyed the plenty of God to keep the measly, piddling goddamn job. And look, I don't even know hell from being the rhythm of life. We used to go ahead and, in Bellingham Bay, in that area right near the bunkhouse where I was born in Canada, and down by the railroad track, we would go out, we'd wade into the water, about 2-3 feet deep, long seagrass, the marsh grasses, waving, and during this certain season, time of the year, there the crab would be pairing, and we would grab them, you see? And they were all there. In other words, we see them in pairs.
Yeah.
And here these guys, thank God, to manage the fisheries. They were boasting about how one season in San Francisco Bay they had over 900,000 pounds in one period. The crab fishing in San Francisco Bay amounted to the millions of pounds. Now if they get 200,000 pounds in a season, it's fair use.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're still killing the male. In China, when you buy a crab at the market, one male, one female.
Uh-huh.
That's how I become very much aware.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah.
See, because that simple thing is that the male female have no way of expelling her roe.
Yeah.
And she will die roe bound. It kills her.
Yeah.
Little look at the waist. Gee.
Yeah.
Of course it'll nourish the other fish.
Yeah.
Now salmon, for example, I learned a few tricks from an Indian. I followed the advice and by God, I went out one day with a skiff. And in less than an hour, we got over 100 pounds of chinook. At present prices, if I were able to lead a boat out like that, I'd pick up almost $500 in 1 hour. Those two guys that were with me, one was the radio operator, the other was a machinist. They had never gotten live salmon like that with the hand where they can get their hands on them, you know. And here's dear old Charlie. I was only 16 years old. Okay? Chief told me, you follow the current, see? So that evening after supper, in the day like this,
yeah.
And we were in that place called Carter Bay, And I watched the tide, and it was coming in. So the tide would come in right out in that arm there was the Pacific Ocean. Right out the arm was the Pacific Ocean, like that. The tide come in, and then here the shore of the bay turn like this, and then go in like this. Oh, yeah. So the tide come in, and they swung, hit that, and then they turned.
Yeah.
See? So I said, you can go on this side. They were going to go ahead and cut across. This is the arm of the bay. They're going to cut off. No. I said, you're not going to get in the fish. Okay? I said, this way. Uh-huh. We didn't even get to the mouth of this. We had 7 fish. There was no more fish. The dang skiff was from the window here to here. That long. Uh-huh. And the boat was just about this wide, at the widest part. It was an emergency skiff for one of the tenders. And here we got 3 guys in there. The wireless operator was about 6'2", he weighed about 170 pounds, and the mechanic was a little shorter fellow, he was about 5'10". He was a stocky guy. He must have weighed about 180. And I was not too heavy, but I weighed about close to 130. And here we got these guys, and we had that much freeboard on that boat. And after he put in the 7 fish in there, I said, no, it's enough, fellas, it's good. So we got back to the dock, and there's just 7 fish. God. And they said, they never got that many salmon in their life. Yeah. In less than an hour, see? And we did it on a hand trolling line. Yeah. Oh, you should see the guy get excited, you know. That machine, when he saw that fish, you know, he stood up in that thing, the thing was rocking. God, he fell in the water. I couldn't swim. Okay? And that was about maybe at least 80 feet of water, right along the shore. That thing just got right down.